What's up, boss? This is Abraham's wallet. We span the gap between the austerity of obedience to God and the prosperity rising from faithfulness. Run your home and your dough like a biblical boss.
Mark, when I've seen you in the past, as you're developing a mustache for the people, I've thought the perfect Aryan is upon us. But now with that striped shirt, I think I always think this, if I ever see you in that striped shirt, you look like a Frenchman. You look like you're in the Foreign Legion.
Fou de Fafon.
Yeah, a little like that.
Yeah.
Are you feeling jaunty today? Joie de vivre? Are you full of joie?
I am. I was thinking about that. I was thinking about the past two episodes, which we've covered a lot of good stuff, but I kind of felt like maybe I didn't bring the energy. So today, the Tour de France is going on right now.
Good. I like it when there's energy there.
I've trimmed this mustache recently, so it's nice and kind of... You know, you can't wear a mustache in July of 2022 without people rolling their eyes at you and saying, Top Gun, huh?
Okay.
And it's 100% true. I'm going for the goose look. That's what I want.
All right.
But yeah, I appreciate... I'm fine being called a little bit of a Francophile in my attire today.
Okay. I have to tell you something great that happened to me this morning. Unexpected. An Abrahamic man named Tyler is out on the road with his family, as he is wont to do, with his wife and six children, loaded up, camping his way across the nation. That's what they do. That's what they do. They've done it before. They're doing it again. And
they're sponsored. They do this for a living?
They're sponsored by his paycheck, I believe.
Oh, okay. But
they've done it before. They've done even longer trips than the three-weeker that they were on just now. And I'm not trying to be obscene in any way, but they made camp this past week in Big Bone Lick State Park in northern Kentucky. And anyways, he contacted me and said, I'm here. Could you meet up this morning before the little ones get roused from the tent? And anyway, I drove down there and met this guy. I'm going to say it again. We have great people.
The listeners are incredible.
I don't know if it's any reflection on us at all, but whatever shingle that we've hung that says we love Jesus, we love the Bible, we love building families, it is attracting a level of clientele that makes me very happy. And it was great to spend some time with Tyler this morning. So I throw that
out
there.
That's fun. I kind of am excited about this episode because we've talked a lot about what we were going to get into this week, and we had a couple ideas and they overlap a bit. But
yeah,
I had this experience this morning that reminded me of the value of a good pumping up, a good motivational talk.
Tell us, did you get pumped up?
No. I was sitting there with my daughter and it was 7:30 in the morning or so. And she is going to be doing cross country in the fall when school starts back up. And last year she had this experience of not being very good at cross country for the first part of the year and kind of running herself into shape. And by the end, she had really learned to suffer. And I said, do you know how much more fun you would have if you started the season in shape? So she has been trying to do some running. And this morning was just a particularly low motivation morning. She was like, I don't want to run. It was raining. I don't know. There was no excitement to run.
Yeah.
And I thought into my memory bank, and I didn't plumb the depths here because I ran into some trouble, but I thought, what kind of thing could show her the value of just saying shut up to your carnal impulses and pushing through and doing something hard. And I thought, you remember that guy David Goggins from the book we read?
Yeah.
Don't ever do this with your 12-year-old daughter. But I thought, I'll show her an Instagram video, because he puts up these videos every day of him running and just saying, you're tougher than you think. You can do it. Get after it. And he says a lot of bad words, which is why I wouldn't recommend it. However, I just thought about the fact that this guy, you know, he says kind of the same thing every single day on Instagram. His message never changes. And people love it because people, I don't think motivation gets you from point A to point B at all, but it's a nice little extra gasoline on the fire. Mm-hmm. If you need to get from point A to point B, it's not bad to be motivated. And sometimes I think, as we've tried to share tips with our audience on how do you become the Abrahamic family leader that we all are striving to be, maybe we haven't laid out the path quite clearly enough. And I want us to talk through, what does that path look like as best we can tell from where we sit right now? And then how do we kind of fire you up and say, we're going to show you the mountain, and then we're going to be standing at the bottom of it yelling attaboys at you while you climb, and you're going to roll and tumble backwards and fall sometimes. And we're going to be like, get up, keep going. And I just think it's fun to do some of that. And my little experience looking at David Goggins' Instagram today said to me, you can't do that too much for people that are on the path.
That's true. So
daughter went out, ran, came back soaked head to toe. It had been pouring, and she brought the dog, who was also soaked head to toe, and personal best on 2.5 miles. So
great.
Motivation.
Good.
It's at least something.
Yeah, that's great. And my thought on this critical path that we're laying out today is that we often address kind of the context of what we hope men are about. We will address concepts along the way. We might get into specifics of how to do this one thing along the way. We've just had a conversation on Volley about mortgages. There's an ongoing conversation about, should I homeschool? And we take these little snapshot things, which deserve some description and some equipping, but we've never pulled back the camera and just described the whole journey for people. And I'm thinking of people like Ethan, who our Volley guy that we met at the pickleball in Texas. And I think just to describe to him, here's the path that you're looking at. And here's the way to get from where you are staring at the fog of the future and thinking, okay, I have this vision of Abrahamic success. I don't know if I can actually even define what that is, and I would like us to help somebody to define that. But I'm not sure of the steps to get there. So I think it'd be really helpful to lay out the steps and where. Let me do this caveat so that I don't do this as we go. It might be the case that you're 80% of the way. And so you think, well, I fumbled and stumbled my way through those early steps. I don't need to hear those anymore. It's still important to me. If I think of my peers, it's still important to me that I would sync up with people who are at the same life stage I am, that we would sync up in the way that we describe the path of life, so that when we run across young men or we run across guys who are in the teeth of a decision, that we'll be able to say, well, this is the way to go. This is the right way. So we're going to be walking through life stages and financial stages as well, right?
Yeah. I also think as we kind of laid this out, I looked at the list and I said, for sure, there are people who are going to say, I am on step 17. And yet there's something I completely never got.
True. That
you're supposed to get on step 4.
Yeah.
And that's not, there's no shame in that. It's just, I think we lay this out and say, you know, I'm trying to learn how to play golf right now, and there's some things I do really well. And there's other things where, as I've taken a lesson, a coach has gone, did anybody ever tell you how to hold a golf club?
No.
And I said, what do you mean? I just hold it. And so there's no shame in like going back and going, I missed some fundamental. And praise the Lord, he's taken me through and I've been able to actually get to a lot of these places we're describing. But I never learned this thing you guys talked about that maybe would be a good goal for a 17-year-old. So we're going to kind of talk through that. But if you hear things and you're listening to this and you're 65, you might be way down the path.
Yeah,
we're not saying you're the maturity level of a 17-year-old if you don't have everything on that list. What we're saying is these are just some good touchstones for what are the things I should be accumulating. And then for a lot of us, what are the things we should be building into our kids and our families so that as they progress along these stages, we've got sort of a timeline for how we hope to see them develop.
Great.
It struck me, again, thinking about just being challenged, and we'll get into high challenge and the need, especially for men to be challenged. I think we'll talk about that a little bit. It happened to me all the time in high school, whether in sports or even in school, somebody said, this is going to be hard and there is a standard and some of you might hit the standard and that would be really great. And it doesn't happen that often to adults. I think sometimes at work we get that, but you know, with money, it tends to be much more about, can I put on a front that makes me look successful enough and make other people. And with family, for the most part, I just don't see people saying there's a standard, dad, that you need to achieve. And we're expecting that it's going to be difficult and we expect you to do it. I don't have that high school wrestling coach that I so struggled with yelling at me and saying, you know, you're falling behind, get up and go faster. And I think some of that's good. So a little bit of that, maybe this time, a lot of that next week as we talk about kind of how to talk to men. But I think that's just something that's missing from most guys I know's life is somebody that will present them a challenging standard and then say, you must do this and it's not going to be easy.
Yes, we will talk about that a lot next week. As we start laying out the what we're calling the critical path to Abrahamic greatness, I first want to just say something. I'll let you go on the list, but I'll just say to set it up, when we talk about Abrahamic greatness, I don't necessarily mean the adulation of people, and I don't mean something that is ethereal. I'm not talking about spiritual greatness, where it's about a character that's been conformed to God's will. I mean something really practical, which is at the end of your life, it's a great visual to think of. You're at the Passover table and you have children and grandchildren who are surrounding your table and everyone's happy to be there. It's not punishment that everybody is in grandpa's presence. Everyone's happy to be around this man because he's a giver and he doesn't have to voice his opinion every moment. And his supportive, loving wife is there. She is the picture in her 60s or 70s. She's the picture of the Proverbs 31 woman. There's fullness around her. She's in bloom. Your children are in bloom. Your grandchildren are in bloom. Your finances are in bloom. And that picture of I have suffered well, as you say. I have built something to last. And I have a healthy family around me. That's what we're talking about when we talk about the path to Abrahamic greatness. So just we're trying to lay out how do you get there from here.
What is step one on the path to Abrahamic greatness?
Well, I feel that as a young man, and all I know to put on an age for that is in the 10 to 15, 16 realm, a young man. So 13 would be a great time to buckle down on this. I really feel like one of the first things that has to be established for a young man is learning self-control. And this is one of the great things about child training, is because you are indoctrinating into a child that they'll have to control themselves. They don't act on their own pleasure all the time. They have to modulate themselves to, well, I have an authority that wants me to do something that I wouldn't want to do on my own. I have to get up and make the bed, for instance. Okay, well, that's a self-control thing to go, I'm not, as you said, I'm not checking in with how I feel right now. This is the right thing for me to do. When I get frustrated at a sibling, I don't yell and throw things. I might do that early on, but as we develop into what I'm just going to call this young man, we develop self-control, and it's a really hard step to take, where that self-control thing isn't just being put upon you from the top down, that an authority is telling you control yourself, but to have a value inside yourself. I want to control myself. I want there to be a measuring stick that's greater than me, that would primarily be God's word, but we learn it usually first with our parents. And then we can self-govern, and we could stand in front of, I just think this is such an easy example. You could stand in front of a buffet line and go, it's not just what tickles my fancy and what pleases my eye. I'm able to make good decisions here because I'm controlling myself. And that value is not present in most American 17-year-olds. So if I'm talking to a 13, 14-year-old, I want to encourage them in ways that they can do that. Having a job is one way to do that. And really, a job, the main thing about having a job young, if it's just mowing yards, it isn't the money. It's the character development that's happening. It's the self-control. I need to act upright towards my customers, or I need to do a professional job. I need to be able to decide, did I do a good job? Oh, I didn't. That's a little bit uneven. I got to go fix that. That kind of self-control is huge for a young man. I'll say one more thing about that what I think of as the first step, learning self-control, and they go hand in hand, taking on responsibility. And I can't help but contrast the critical steps to the American culture, which says do everything in your power to not have responsibility. If you can shirk it off on somebody else, do it. If the teacher says, well, you do these first two things and the second two things are optional, nobody does the optional things. But to say, no, I want to take on responsibility, which would include making the bed, which would include the responsibility of mowing somebody's yard regularly, et cetera. So that would be my first step for like a 15-year-old, is start owning self-control and look for places to take on responsibility.
Yeah, there were two things that kind of stuck out to me on this one. And I'm assuming a Jesus-following young man at this point. If you're hearing this and you came to Christ at 30, then you have to kind of go back, and I think you can certainly become a self-controlled man without being a regenerated follower of Christ. Sure. However, there were two things that stuck out to me that I think at least one of them would be unique to the Jesus follower. And I'm reading this book right now that I've told you about a few times, and I want to do a whole podcast on it. It's just blowing my mind. It's called The Mortification of Sin by John Owen, an old Puritan. And it's really stinking good about learning how to hate your sin.
Great.
The way that God hates it. And he's just full of, one of his main points is most of us hate the sins that make our lives worse.
Yes.
And if that's the only sin you hate, you should probably figure out if you're saved, because I would bet you're not.
Wow.
And he really says, you know, he lived in a time when the Puritans were very anti-Catholic. So a lot of times he goes on these Catholic rants, but he kind of says there's systems in the world to tamp down your sin enough that it doesn't interfere with your life and doesn't make you feel bad and all that. And that will kill you if that's all you do. And the main job of the Christian is to be killing your sin all the time. Mm. And the only way you can do that is through the increased indwelling of the Holy Spirit and presence of the Lord. And so I think as a young man, starting to learn to kill sin is a critical step that I know began in me when I was probably 10 years old and could conceive of sinfulness and could distinguish a thought. So, and say like, this is sin. It's work that I expect to still be doing if I'm here at age 95. So it's not a completed work by the time you're 17, but that's one of them, is just starting to learn to hate your sin like God hates it. I think that's work that a teenager can begin to do. And the other one is just to learn to work hard and voluntarily embrace discomfort. For me, this was like my first exposure to this was probably in junior high sports. But there was value that I still draw from to this day as a teenager of going through things that were really hard. I went through some family things that were really hard that I wanted to respond a certain way, and I responded a different way, and that felt extremely uncomfortable. There was physical challenges and sports and things like that, but I think that's another thing that young men can really dig into at that pre-adulthood phase of life.
Okay, so that's sort of, you know, managing yourself a little bit. I suggest that by age 17, I know that seems unthinkable American-wise. I know it's not unthinkable biblically when I think of characters like Joseph, who we think was between 14 and 17 when he was sent out by his father to check on his brothers.
King Joash, 7 when he took
there
over.
There you go. Or a character like Timothy. But by age 17, I think it's important to start learning how to take care of yourself. That doesn't mean that you're not in submission to your parents, but you aren't thinking, well, what will mommy and daddy do for me right now? You're starting to think, I need to manage my own schedule. That is, I consider, well, when do I need to get up to have time to do what I need to do and be at school on time? You're managing your money, and you're thinking, well, I know I want to go on a date Saturday night, so I'm going to budget money for that, put that money aside. Let's see what I could do this week in the way of pizza with buddies. I can't spend all of that because I need to manage that money. What you're learning at that taking care of yourself kind of stage is you're learning how to plan, and you're forecasting into the future. You're thinking, well, I have a test tomorrow at 8 a.m. There's an invite that's out to go out at 11 tonight. I'm sorry, guys. I can't do it because I'm planning for what tomorrow will feel like, and I want to be sharp. This is an important test, and et cetera. So that taking care of yourself, managing yourself, and not hoping that mom will come up behind you and wipe your nose and clean up your messes behind you, but you just own your space. You own your room. When you make yourself some food, you clean up after yourself. You're just, it's an extension of that self-control and responsibility, which is I'm now just going to be in charge of my world. I'm going to maintain my car. I'm not going to wait on dad to come bother me. I think it's time for an oil change, son, because you got a reminder, however you keep it. And you go, my car probably needs an oil change right now. And you're growing into that sort of self-managing adulthood.
I tried to kind of think through some of the financial implications of each of these stages. And on this one, no shocker to our loyal listeners, I thought about budgeting. And I think that this is a time in life when you should know how to keep a basic budget by the time you're, you know, whatever we want to call it, 17 to 20 range,
yeah,
reaching what society would consider adulthood. So I think knowing how to keep a budget, I think, like you said, knowing how to get your hands on more money than you need right now and say no to the flesh so that you can put that money to work for the future,
yeah,
instead of enjoying it today. Proverbs 21:20 came to my mind, which said, "The wise have wealth and luxury, but fools spend whatever they get."
Oh, that's a great one.
If you've ever been around anybody who's in poverty, that's, you know, that verse is just true, true, true.
Let's hear it again.
The wise have wealth and luxury, but fools spend whatever they get.
Yep.
I know people that make seven-figure incomes and spend it all.
Yeah.
They're not going to be wealthy.
You're working with small amounts of money at that stage of the game, but the way that you're learning to handle it really matters. And so I'm remembering a piece of advice my dad gave me early on in my marriage. And he said, when you have a cross of opinion with your wife and you are starting to bow up, and you're starting to put an angry sentence together in your head, or you're about to bow up, he said, it's a good idea to ask yourself, will this thing matter 2 weeks from now? Will it matter 2 weeks from now? Who does the dishes tonight, for instance? That's a great question to ask yourself. And then just say, well, no, I don't have to win this. This doesn't matter. I'm not going to make this an issue. Move on. Similarly, I'm thinking of those early days of making some money. And we can get so tempted. Well, I do have this budget that I sat down and planned out, and I plan on saving this. But oh, they've rolled out a new chalupa at Taco Bell. It seems so interesting and fascinating to me. And it's a good idea when you're at that stage to just ask yourself, will this little decision that's in front of me that's tempting me to break my budget, will it matter 2 weeks from now? Or is this just kind of a throwaway feel good moment that I could pass by? That's a great moment to start utilizing that self-control that you've developed and go, no, this doesn't matter. I'm not doing this. I like what you say about putting money toward the future.
This particular financially minded Abraham's Wallet podcaster is not going to ever condemn you if you choose the chalupa. I'm not going to do that because that's a delicious combination of pride and Mexican flavors.
Okay. All right.
But just a couple other things. One, like I said, you can identify and engage with disciple makers and mentors.
Yes. Yeah, go on.
This is a thing that I think you know, this is when you and I met, and I can't claim, hey, I was on the Abrahamic path and I knew how to identify a disciple maker. Somebody else who had done it grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and said, hey, we're going to be meeting. Here's what it looks like.
Yeah.
There will be expectations of you, but I didn't know what discipleship was at the time.
Yeah.
But the Lord used that to help me sort of set up a pattern so that by the time I was 30 and I moved to a city where I didn't know any Christians, I knew how to kind of seek out, hey, this would be a good person for me to learn from and spend time with.
Yeah.
And that served me very well. And it's a skill I learned when I was 16 years old.
Yes.
So I know some patriarch, amazing Jesus follower graybeards who are constantly getting duped on this front.
Oh.
And you're like, you are spending time with that guy, but you're so wise and he's such a knucklehead. And So this is one where it doesn't have to be Jesus disciple makers. You need to learn how to find those people for sure. You also need to learn how to, who are the people I would trust to talk to me when it comes to business decisions? Who are the people I would trust to talk to me on parenting, on marriage, all that stuff? Basically the things you come to the Abraham's Wallet podcast for.
Yeah.
So I think that's a big one. And being old and successful does not mean that you necessarily nailed this. So I would just practice that skill, whatever age you're at, and say, am I capable of identifying the folks who I'm going to take advice from and learn from?
When you say that the gray beards get duped, do you mean that they invest their time in not good places and they should be more selective?
Yeah, I've seen that for sure. I've also seen them say, man, this guy is so smart on business. And I go, well, you're smart, so yeah, let me hear him. And I start listening to the recommended mentor and saying, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
Oh.
So I'm sure I've done that too. I'm sure that I have gotten excited about somebody and thought and put them up on a pedestal and I was wrong. I've probably been that guy for some people. Who knows? but I think that the takeaway is this is the time before you turn 20 years old, you should know, hey, if I plop you down in a city that you've never been in, you could find some mentorship there. You would know how to go about that. You would know what the conversation looks like. Because you won't always be finding mentors who are lifetime disciple makers. They might have no idea what you're talking about.
That's right.
And you should get comfortable with how to approach an older guy and say, I would like to learn from you. Could we meet and could it look like this?
Yeah. And I know we've talked about this subject before, but I've been around older guys who were uncomfortable with that setup. Like, I'm not, you know, Steve, you're fine. I don't need to like disciple you or anything like that. And I'm thinking to myself, would you shut up? I just want to spend time with you. You have stuff that I want. And so you do have to learn how to finesse that and go fishing for wisdom from them, even if they don't like the sort of the hierarchy of, well, I'm going to be your leader. A lot of old hippie guys that I've known didn't like that setup. And I'm thinking, well, I'm going to do what you say, whether you like it or not. And it's a skill to learn how to draw wisdom out of people.
The last thing that I had on this one was learning how to present yourself. I think that's somewhat related to what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
But you know, what came to my mind was even things like, do you know how to dress well without being a joke? In high school, I went through a little bit of an identity crisis and I thought, well, I need to dress in a way that expresses my unique self. And I went to the mall and I bought this terrible, like sparkly short sleeve button down shirt that was different colors depending on where you stood. And I just went to my 22, because it was a little delayed for COVID, my high school reunion. And I was wearing just a normal shirt and somebody came up and they're like, Parrot, you're the shirt guy. And I was just like, man, I did not know the implications of that fashion mistake.
Oh, but, how funny.
You know, there's people who grew up in a town of 1,500 people, and they might actually struggle to know how to present themselves if they were plopped down in a boardroom. Similarly, there's people who grew up in Manhattan, and they would have a very hard time relating to a room full of guys who work with their hands all day. I think you should start poking around in different places and say, can I present myself in a relatable way? Before I turn 20 years old, do I know how to, if I get invited to a wedding, am I going to be able to pick a suit that fits me well and show up and be appropriate in that setting? And if I get invited to a rodeo, will I look like a goober with cargo shorts on? Or do I know to dress appropriately? I don't think it's just about how you dress, but I actually think the older I get that there is some... that's an area of life that was just totally hand waved to me. Like, it doesn't matter. And I'm like, the way you present yourself actually matters as a man. And so you should put a little thought into it. And ideally before you move to step three, because if you want to be finding women and business connections and things like that, you should present yourself well so that you have good options there.
That's right. I think we could probably do an entire episode on that subject because it is so shoulder shrugged today by the culture where anything goes. you can wear pajama pants on an airplane, flip-flops everywhere. And the fact is, I mean, I know we all kind of give each other license to do whatever we want, but the fact is, when somebody presents themselves respectable, they get respect for it. And as you say, dressing well for a funeral or a wedding, and the way you present yourself when you meet older men, okay, you're gonna have coffee with a 65-year-old. You landed a coffee. You're 18. You landed a coffee with a 65-year-old, and you shouldn't come looking like you just rolled out of bed. Your look should say, this is important to me. I'm up for this moment, and I care about how this goes. And I don't think there's any value given to that culturally right now. And I think it's a great point. So as you said, that takes us into step three, which is, I'm thinking that you're around college age. You might be out of college, and it's now time to start thinking, or maybe you forego college, and it's now time to start thinking, how do I train for a trade? And you should envision how what you know will make you a living in your 20s. And you should start accumulating skills to start building something. Not doing what I largely did, which is taking random jobs. And I was thinking, well, if I could get $12 doing this thing as opposed to $8 doing this thing, I'll just do the $12 thing. Never thinking I want to be systematically building up a book of skills that I can apply somewhere. So that training for a trade, envisioning what do I want, which you might not know exactly which role in, say, the financial world or the business world you want. But if you know you're going in that direction, there are steps that you can take that will expose you to that world. They'll get your head in the game, get you some experience. You could be a cashier somewhere, and that would still start walking you down that road. So accumulating experience, skills, relationships, et cetera.
Yeah. But, you know, we've talked about both of our stories, and my career story was not at all, hey, I'm on the path to becoming a financial planner. I didn't even have that in my brain probably until I was in the second half of my 30s. But what I did do really well from the time I was 22 on is always look for roles that would accumulate skills, relationships, or experience that would open doors for me. You know, I said, hey, there's some big names that are, I have the opportunity to take a job at the International Monetary Fund. That's a big name. They don't pay as much as Goldman Sachs, which is also a big name, but they give me the opportunity to kind of have that unique thing on my resume that even Ivy League school, none of my classmates have that name. Mm-hmm. They all have random investment bank. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of unique, and it'll be interesting. And then from there, it was, hey, there's an opportunity to change jobs, and I would learn some completely different area of finance than I had been working on. That would be valuable.
Yeah.
And there was another job I can remember taking in my late 20s where it was like, man, this sucks. And I'm not developing relationships here. I don't want to be like the people here. And I left that job very quickly. So I think if you can think about skills, relationships, and experience, sometimes that path will mean, like we said at the very beginning, just a job that works you to the bone. That is not something you want to do when you're 40. That, you know, when you have four kids, you don't want to be working 100-hour weeks. But when you're 22, it's actually really helpful to know what it looks like to be demanded, to have a level of excellence demanded of you that wouldn't happen if you were at kind of entry level at kind of a lower tier firm somewhere doing whatever it is that you could do at the highest level and bust your butt for a year or two.
Yeah.
So that's where, like, experience, even if I had been, I'm trying to think what's completely unrelated. If I had been doing something totally outside of my current world, but I had just learned the value of busting my chops in a way that I never would at other jobs. That would be valuable experience. So I think those are good steps to take as you're thinking about early career stuff. And the other one I had just is, don't go into debt, because that's the current that the culture is taking you down. So you said college. A lot of people just say, well, I guess that's the thing, and they just go to college. Mm-hmm. And we've talked a little bit about that on here. We'll probably do more college talk, but getting an art history degree and having $250,000 of debt does not set you up for success on all of the steps we're going to talk to after this one.
Yeah.
However, I will also say that you should not avoid debt just because Dave Ramsey or your church people say it's always a sin. Some of the guys listening to this are going to need a postdoctorate degree to fulfill God's calling on their lives.
Yeah.
And others probably could have skipped their senior year of high school and been great because God's taking them down a different path. And we're big fans of business ownership and entrepreneurship, and generally that requires a little less education, but not always. And I think there's dogmas out there that are just goofy when it comes to, well, college is required, or college is terrible and a sham. Yeah. And, you know, I would just be thoughtful and say, if I'm going to do something at a very young age, is what we're talking about, that is going to saddle me with obligations potentially for the next 15 or 20 years, I need to be pretty clear on the value I'm getting back from that. And if it's there, great, green light. But if it's not, then don't let yourself be just taken down that river because it's the way everybody else is going.
Yeah. And the number one thing to watch out for in those early job years is consumer debt. By that we mean,
yes.
Let's say you get your first job, you're in an apartment. You should find a roommate, by the way. I'll put a little plug in here for you should find a roommate, not only because it'll be cheaper to live, but because you have to compromise with someone who lives under your roof with you. You have to compromise about how the refrigerator works and when the living room is cleaned up. And you have to go, well, I wanted to put my college welcome mat, but you want to put your college welcome mat. You have to learn how to deal with somebody. And I think it's a good rule of thumb. Try not to live on your own, where you're your own master and everything's just the way that you want. If you do that, then when you get married, it's going to be that much more painful because you were used to having everything the way you wanted all the time. And that's not life. That's not a healthy life. It doesn't go your way all the time. So, get yourself a roommate, and the inclination is, hey, I have a good salary now. Let's furnish this whole place, and make it the way that I would, the way I see on TV, what a bachelor pad should be like. And that can often be really foolish, especially if you're burning your budget to do that. I can tell you most of that stuff that you're buying for yourself, your wife will not approve of, and it won't make it into your married home. So you should just kind of make do. That's my two cents. Yeah.
You know, you're speaking here from the standpoint of somebody. Could you maybe describe the furnishings in your apartment at the Pineapple Place where you were living when I first met you?
Yes, I can. I remember I didn't have a bed. I think I had bought a single mattress off of a friend for $50, and it laid on the floor. The single mattress laid on the floor. I remember Mark Douglas. It was a Mark Douglas inspired design. The shelves in my room was a layer of cinder blocks, a 2x8 board, a layer of cinder blocks, a 2x8 board, a layer of cinder blocks, a 2x8 board, shelves. We had some kind of hand-me-down couch in our living room. And someone had given my roommate Ba Hong. Someone had given Ba a TV. And
it had a VCR built into it too, so you could watch Sting music videos during the day.
That's right.
If I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the compare that to my experience. First, I literally had the U-Haul driving from Princeton, New Jersey to Washington, D.C. And I was going to marry my wife in 6 months, but I needed a place to live for 6 or 7 months. And I had agreed with some guys from college that I sort of knew to live in an apartment with them in downtown D.C., which was already super pricey.
Mm.
And I roll up and we're starting to bring the first stuff out of the moving truck. And the guy who was kind of in charge of this, the lease and things like that, he goes, okay, so the rent is $1,200 a month for each of us. And then I went ahead and furnished it. And so we're just going to amortize that out. So everybody else is going to have an extra $400 a month for furniture. And I literally, because I was, this was a handshake deal. And in that moment, I felt like this young man had broken our handshake.
Right.
My brother-in-law, who was helping with the U-Haul, I turned around and I said, hey, can I sleep on your floor? And he said, I guess. And so I said, okay, put all the stuff back in the truck. And that was the last time I talked to that joker.
Wow. But, a manly move.
That was a trap that I remember sitting with my fiance, now wife, that night and saying, this was reasonable, right? And she said, thank you for not spending $400 a month for furniture that you wouldn't even own at the
end.
That
is awesome. I wonder if I would have slunk out. I would have slunk into the place going, wow, I guess it's worse than I thought. Oh, well, good for you. That's a great story.
No, I was not taking that crap. So we've referenced it. And there's a chance that you won't even have time to find a roommate if you get on step four quick enough. But step four of the Abrahamic critical path to greatness is?
Find yourself a wife. The Bible
as quickly
says,
as possible.
Whoever finds a wife finds a good thing and receives a blessing from the Lord. So why in the world would you wait into your 30s to get a wife?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you go, hey, I have developed, think of our boy Ethan, I think he's 19. I have developed self-control. I know how to manage myself. I have a vision about where I'm going. And before I get set up and start making my own little life that's built around me, why wouldn't I have a little filly come beside me and let's start building something together early on? And why wouldn't we have a couple of youngsters before age 25? Why not?
Well, it's interesting because what you're not saying is find the first woman who agrees to be your wife.
No.
That is not at all what you're saying. And it would be better to wait until you're 35 to get married than to marry a woman who is not the right choice.
Ding. Hear, hear.
However, here in your notes, as I'm looking at kind of the notes you prepared, you said that you should make sure she's, you listed three characteristics. Characteristic one, optimistic. Number two, loves family life. And number three, she's hardy. So she needs to be able to maybe survive a winter in the Yukon or something like that. Or maybe she's, you said a little filly. I don't know about that. I'm more picturing somebody who's got some...
You're picturing a big boned girl. Is that what you're saying?
Heft. Somebody who's hardy.
You thinking maybe she has Slavic roots and she has an Aunt Olga.
Now we're saying it out loud, I think we can leave all the physical traits to our listeners. You guys go pick whatever tickles your fancy. Everybody has their own preferences there. But you should find somebody who is shares all of your kind of vision and mission, whatever you've been able to scrape together by the time you're 22, which is probably not as much as you'll have by the time that you've been with her for 2 or 3 years. But I think that putting some effort into that and not accepting this norm that you're going to wait until much later, it is really, really important.
Did you like my little list there that I came up with? My list of three things?
I would say if you meet somebody and they... my kids are at camp right now and there's a bunch of high school students running. It's like a day camp. And they came back and they said, such and such says she never wants children. Well, I don't believe that this 18-year-old girl probably never will want children.
Yeah.
However, if I was an 18-year-old boy, I would say we can cross this one off the list, at least for now. Because that doesn't meet my love's family life list of qualifications for potential wives.
Well, while you're mentioning camp, I think we said this to some of these girls that were our girls' counselors at Sky Ranch. And that kind of, we can sleep on bunk beds for 10 weeks in a row because we care about girls, and we can sweat all day long while we serve them and pick up their bags and water bottles and tell them where to be all the time. That's what I mean by hardy. Is somebody who is, they don't expect that life is going to be serving them all the way, and that in order for them to be happy, everything has to be exactly right. I remember when I was dating my wife, one time I ran out of gas in my car, which is a very early 20s kind of thing to do, ran out of gas. We were on the interstate, and I think we had to walk a mile or something to find gas, and I was so vexed. I was so frustrated and heavy and had smoke coming out of my ears. And the whole time, this girl beside me is just going like, this isn't a big deal. We can, it's fine. We can walk. We get gas. And I, you know, poverty mindset, I'm thinking, now I'm going to have to buy a gas can. Those cost up to $8. And then I'm going to have to walk all the way back. And she's like, this is life. This is okay. This is all right. I remember coming away from that going like, she's all right. I like that.
Yeah.
And so that hardiness, when I say optimistic, I'm baking into that what you had mentioned, which is, does she share your enthusiasm of your vision for the future? When you describe the Abrahamic life, does she go, man, that's so exciting? It doesn't mean that she had perfect parents, but it probably means that somebody was in her life enough to demonstrate for her, this is what a nurturing mother helpmeet would be like. Somebody that can come alongside, can make up for your deficiencies. Let's build a vision together. And has that, the Proverbs 31 phrase is, she's laughing at the days to come. She has a vision for the future, which is hopeful, which is exciting, which brings joy. And you find a girl like that and you go, she's hardy, she's optimistic, and she has a love for family life. She doesn't see the idea of like, well, I know, I mean, I guess we'll have to have kids at some point, but I want to accomplish all these things in my career. I would want a woman who goes, I want the family life and I want to have kids. Now at the moment I might be working on a career and that might be something that's in my life, but boy, my heart is toward family life. And you'll notice in my short list of three things, hottest girl on the internet was not on the list. And I would say this to any young man who thinks he's of marrying age. It is so easy to overvalue immediate attractiveness. And you want to be attracted to your wife. You want to think that she's pretty. Do you think that you have to feel like she's the hottest girl I've ever seen and nobody matches her? Sometimes I hear men say that kind of thing about their woman. She's the hottest fox in the universe. And I think, I don't know that that's going to last. I don't know that that's the best way to choose a wife. If you'll get a modicum of attractiveness out of your wife, but you can find optimistic, hardy, and someone who loves family life and shares that vision, man, go.
If you just hang out at our age with people that are in their 40s and 50s and 60s, you start to see everybody ages. And
yes, you do.
Beauty is fleeting. It doesn't really matter who you are and what you looked like at one point, unless you're Tom Cruise, then you're going to start looking older at some point, and you want somebody who's paired up with you. A couple other quick things. One is on this one, it's okay to meet somebody and go, wow, they're awesome, but they're not for me. And yes. I've heard this in church world before, where I actually, there was a church when we were in DC that was famous for telling its young people, if you're dating someone and they love Jesus and you love Jesus and you're both single, then there is no good reason why you two shouldn't be married. And I thought, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
They even said, you don't have to pray about it.
Right. It's okay to go, well, you have a dreams of living on a farm and I have dreams of, you know, practicing law in Manhattan, and we both share a vision for family, and you're you know, this hearty, optimistic person, but one of us would feel like we had just given up our dreams, and yeah, so let's go different directions. You can also find people who are awesome and you're just not attracted to at all, and yeah, you shouldn't feel like you're supposed to marry that person either.
Yeah.
So feel some freedom there. We're not telling you just grab a hold of the first person that checks the boxes. And the other thing I wanted to say here is, this maybe a little bit too financial advisory, but put yourself in a financial position to buy this woman a big fat diamond when you meet her. Whether or not you actually do it is a separate issue. You don't have to spend $10,000 on an engagement ring. I don't really care if you do. But I think this is part of that whole developing mastery over your environment and the ability to deny oneself and put other goals yes. ahead. But you should be able to, by the time you're ready to marry, you should be in a position where you were able to somehow scrape together whatever that dollar amount is, $10,000 maybe. I remember I got engaged right after college was over, and I didn't have a whole lot of ways to come up with that kind of scratch. So I was a bicycle racer, and shout out to our productive hobbies episode from back in the day. I just bought and sold race bikes because that's what I knew. And that's how I came up with money to buy an engagement ring. So you can be creative about this. But I do think being capable of coming up with the easiest of the five capitals to acquire is a good measuring rod for you to go, am I the type of guy who's really ready to take on the responsibility of leading a wife? And that right there is about a perfect segue to critical path to Abrahamic greatness, step number 5.
It's to dream with her, spiritually lead and pastor her. That is its own chapter of life, is learning, having your marriage, be the number one focus of your life, aside from your relationship with God itself. It's your number one hobby. And you're learning how to care for a wife. This is straight out of Deuteronomy 26, which says that you stay home from the army for a year and you learn how to care for your wife. You don't inherently know how to do that. You might have seen great husbanding in your home of origin, but you don't know how to care for this particular woman until you live with her. You're having sex with her. She has her own combination of personality and experience. You don't know what wires you're going to trip. We don't know what her real strengths are. You don't know how her spiritual gifts demonstrate themselves in various situations. And so having a period of time where you just learn how to pastor her is really valuable. Why I said that, I just remembered, as we're talking, we're describing best case scenario. We're describing, if we could design the world, these are the steps that you would walk through. And I would let me go back, as I'm mentioning husbanding and fathering and the involvement of your parents. you would want those gray beards that you mentioned, including your father, your physical father, you would want them to be involved in the choosing of this woman. And you would want to say, hey, I'm kind of dating this girl. I want y'all to spend time with her and I want your input. Because these old gray beards, they're not impressed with flashy earrings and great makeup. They can see through that instantly and go, wow, that's a woman of character. You want to hold on to her. And their weigh in matters a lot. So anyways, you've got this woman and you're developing skill in caring for her.
I'm trying to think back because, you know, I was still a youngin' when you and Dora got engaged. I definitely remember you showing me the ring before you took off on the trip that would culminate in that engagement. But you were probably the closest thing to a gray beard that I involved in the wife selection process of my own. So do you remember that trip where we swung through Cincinnati?
And yes, I do.
I said, okay, what do you think? Yes or no?
I do remember that. I sure do.
So I'm not sure I was as intentional as we would instruct someone to be now there, but some of that just comes naturally as you have a close relationship with anybody who's mentoring or discipling you, that you're not going to tie yourself to a woman without asking their thoughts if at all possible.
It's during this stage of the formation of your marriage where I would say that you want to start dreaming as specifically as you can about where you're going. How should our gifts mesh, our spiritual gifts? Do some volunteer work during that time. Take a few trips, but take a mission trip together and serve. And be involved in a Bible study together, not just because you want to learn in the Bible study, you're actually learning about each other while you're in that context and what lights her up. What is she really good at relationally? Again, how do our gifts complement one another? And I think during that season, which I think of at least being this precious year that you want to protect, is doing your first work at trying to toy with a vision statement for your family. And I know that the future is going to be foggy. It might sound very general, but you're starting to think we want to serve God together as a family and we're headed in this direction. I just think those things are good to get ahead of, as opposed to, well, we've got three kids and we're knee deep in a career and we've got money going on. Now, what's our vision again? If you have to do that, great. But best case would be that you would start that way as soon as you're married, moving together.
Yeah, I think that principle of not going to war means more than what most Christians that I run into think it means. I hear people that are saying, we just got married and we're going to go do missions abroad. And I say, terrible idea. It could be, hey, I mean, for me, I was a newlywed with a wife in medical school, and that sucked because I saw her way less than most people would. So personally, if it's avoidable, I wouldn't recommend a super crushing job or school for either of you in that first year of marriage. I wouldn't recommend fostering children. You know,
it's a bad time. Transitions and mass responsibility, period.
Yeah. The Lord could give you children and then you'll welcome them joyfully. But in terms of voluntarily taking on extreme challenges, I would say you're already taking on a pretty big one. So think about that, not just meaning literally don't go to war. Think about we're supposed to be wholly focused on relational development in this phase. And that's the other thing I had just kind of noted here is this is where you start to have the hard work of smashing your money vision together. We've said it a million times on this podcast, but creating a family vision statement is step one to successfully deploying your resources and even to accumulating them properly. So that might help you guys figure out here's how we're supposed to earn money as a couple and eventually as a family, because this is what we're put here to do. So I would say go nail that. If you're listening to this and you're a newlywed, go do family vision statement. You can swing at it yourself, or you can go to outpostacademy.net and do a family vision statement course there. But do that and figure out your weak spots and use the mentor gathering skills you've already kind of developed as an individual to shore up areas where you go, wow, we never realized that we suck at fights. We don't know how to have conflict. And, you know, Stephen, you said, well, she's come from a place where she's at least seen kind of good family models and things like that. That may not be the case. You could both come from totally shattered to bits houses.
True.
And we just need to identify that stuff
and
have a plan for, here's how we're going to approach. Like, we don't know. We have only seen terrible relations between parents or between married people when it comes to how they deal with conflict, or we've only seen infidelity creep into marriages over time. And you need to just to call those things out and put a big spotlight on them and say, we don't have infidelity in our hearts, but both of our parents, the families we came from, that was a thing. So we're going to be extra aggressive, and we're turning the ship around for our families here. That's going to take some work. So marking all those things out, as well as the things that you're particularly strong in, will be very good work to do in this phase.
Two other things came to mind. One is, there's no stage at which mentors are not valuable. So if you could find somebody who's ahead of you when it comes to marriage that you could spend time with, I know there's studies out there that are mentoring studies, where let's talk through conflict. How have you guys have been married for 40 years? We've been married for 6 months. Tell us how you do conflict. And those kinds of relationships are golden. If you can find those at your church or anywhere else, grab them. The second thing is that you should be, just like in the early stages of being a young man, you're wanting to put the pieces in place so that as you grow up, you've got self-control, responsibility, et cetera, that are built in there. In the early days of your marriage, you want to be building in financial skills and habits that are going to serve you when you've got $5 million in your pocket in 20 years. So all of the things that you would do with money, celebrating with money, spending money well and healthily, saving money, giving money, investing, all the things that you would do with money, you should be doing in those early days. And you're gonna unearth, like, well, it's hard for me to celebrate, actually, because I think there's some poverty that I have to scrimp and save every cent and I shouldn't celebrate. Oh, well, let's work through that right now. Because that first year is kind of like you're on a practice field and the stakes are really low. It's just the two of us. We don't have as much as we're going to have in the future. Let's just work on all of those things. And there might be some deliverance to go through. There might be confession of sin. You might have to work on debts that are there, et cetera. But all those things should be handled in that first year, as far as, you know, your money demons, if you will.
Yeah.
We've got on our hands like two married 22-year-olds with no kids, and we're over an hour in. So I recommend that we put a button right there.
Let's see. We're on step 5 on the critical path to Abrahamic greatness, and Valhalla is step 13. So we've got some ground to cover.
And I don't want to rush it. So we'll pause it there, and we'll return next time, and we'll let you start having children, and we'll start building a family. All right.
Until then, we're gonna tell you to have way more and way sooner kids than you thought you were ready for.
All right. We'll see you then.